Hello, and welcome to the Weekly Comic Spotlight on the Comic Book Page podcast. My name is John Mayer. In this episode, we'll be discussing recently released comics. One from DC, one from Marvel, and at least one other. As always, we'll keep major spoilers to a minimum, but we'll discuss general plot points and storylines of the comics we review. This is Weekly Comics Spotlight 518 for comics originally released on July 12th, 2017. Now, we are veering from our usual format of a Marvel, a DC, and some other, because it's July. It's time for the independents. So we're going all indie.
Excellent.
We're doing it for a couple of weeks this time.
Yeah.
Yeah, I thought of that, and I thought, that's clever. Anyways, we're going all independents this time. We're doing it in alphabetical order by title. So that starts us off this time around with Centipede number 1 from Dynamite Entertainment. And I'll be honest, this is one I was really curious to see. How could they take this Atari video game from the 80s, I think it was,
yep,
and turn this into a compelling story? And then, of course, Francesco Francavilla is the, I guess he just did the cover art. Anytime I see his name attached to something, I mean, he's a great artist, don't get me wrong. I just get a little annoyed with his signature being all over the story. That kind of takes me out of it. This is one where I pre-ordered the first issue. We're recording in advance, so we're looking at a PDF version. But this was one that had caught my eye at least that much to pre-order the first, but only the first issue. Because I just didn't know how this was going to work as a comic book story. And I'll be honest, I thought the first page of the story, they did a little bit of kind of a fake out there, where we've got this guy who's telling us he's a scientist, he's checking these satellite radio wave transmissions from other planets, and learning about, you know, it's like an interstellar outreach program is what he calls it, and harvesting, or stealing, as he's saying, essentially the myths, the cultures, the broadcasts from other societies. Like, wow, this is a really cool concept. But then they do the twist at that of, it's another planet where this guy is on, and they're stealing our stuff. I'm like, okay. So they came close to breaking the fourth wall on this with this Dale Trell character, but he's very clear that he's talking into this radio. He knows nobody's on the end of it, but he needs a friend, so he's going to imagine there is one, even though he knows there's not. But if it helps him get through the day, which he kind of needs, because he may be the last person on his planet alive. And it's good that Dale is a reasonably interesting character, because he's really the only character in this comic, unless you count maybe the spiders that attack him at one point, or the title character of the Centipede, who makes what I would consider a glorified cameo there at the end. This is one where I thought they did some interesting storytelling decisions. Again, the invisible friend, the narration of the character, all of that. And it's a very wordy comic for something that has one guy in it. But it kind of worked surprisingly well, but it didn't get far enough into the story for me to be sure if I need to come back for another issue or not. It was interesting, but it wasn't successful in completely hooking me, I guess is what I'm trying to say there.
I can definitely see that. It's a tall order. It's the, if you recall the Atari game, you were never a gamer, but Centipede's pretty ubiquitous.
A video gamer at that era I was, because it wasn't a big investment. Plop the quarter in, play the game, or whatever you're done. Yeah.
I mean, it was a side, back and forth, side shooter, and, you know, you were, the Centipede came down and dropped some spiders, and that's pretty much it.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe the occasional mushroom, I can't remember. But it was mindless fun. Was there a trackball? Might have been a trackball involved. Anyway, it doesn't matter.
I think that was Missile Command you were thinking about.
Okay. And so they didn't have a lot of subject matter to work with.
I would say next to none.
Last week we had Clue, which had some not only a board game but also a movie, a source material kind of for inspiration. This has very little source material for inspiration. And I thought Max Bemis did a pretty darn good job mining that, what little he had, and cobbling together a story around it. And Max Bemis was been on my radar for a little while. He wrote my favorite two-issue arc of Crossed, And he did a really cool miniseries, Last X-Men on Earth, I think it was called, or worst The Last X-Men.
Worst X-Men ever.
Yeah, Worst X-Men ever, which was a really fun story. And so he's been on my radar for those two things. I don't know what else he's done except for this.
Fool Killer.
Ooh. Okay.
Is that good or an ooh bad?
Well, kind of ooh bad because I don't think that thing should exist. So, anyway.
So you're kind of a fool killer killer?
I'm a fool killer killer, but I never read it. So, you know, maybe it's great. But those other two things I really liked from him. And he was able to kind of cobble together a story using some interesting choice of how his solo character can be talking to himself throughout the thing. Mm-hmm. So that kind of worked. And, you know, he is someone you can pull for a little bit, I think. He won me over. The Centipede makes one appearance.
But a large one. It's a huge centipede.
It's a huge centipede. For that reason, I'm kind of looking forward to seeing what happens to the centipede and what he does and what that interaction is like. But to your point, you kind of get the gist of what this is all about. And I don't know that this is a compelling ongoing series, 6-issue miniseries, whatever it is, enough to justify the expense. This might be something more along the lines of, hey, if it's in your local library, why don't you check it out that way? I don't know if you need to invest all that time and effort into this. He did a lot with very little.
I agree with that. And I think, again, the storytelling conventions, it was surprisingly compelling given the complete almost lack of any real serious story from the source material to work with. So I was pleasantly astonished by that. But there's also an aspect here where the next issue is going to be him versus the centipede, presumably, which means it's going to be fundamentally kind of different than this issue. You know, maybe a little more action-based or something. And that's not a good or a bad thing, but it means this issue, if you love it, it's not necessarily that you're going to love the next issue or vice versa. If you didn't love this, maybe you will love the next. It's not, it makes this one not a good barometer for should you stay with the series or not.
Well, so, I think my favorite character moments from this are some of the flashback stuff and the establishing of who this character is. And they've done that.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know how much more he can do. Maybe he can mine some more of that, but it could be all action. And I don't know if the action sequences from this issue were my favorite. So I don't think an all action issue, which it may or issue two may or may not be, would be as well received by me as this one was.
Given the ground they covered, it's like, what else do they need to do?
Yes.
And what else would satisfy us?
Yes. And it's almost like you did yeoman's work here. You did your best with not a lot. Maybe it's best served as a one shot.
I think this actually may have done better as a maybe a little bit longer, but as a one shot or something. Because, I mean, it's not like this is a satisfying conclusion. It's not. It's to be continued. And there's a part of me here on this last page that wants to have a, you know, insert, you know, what is it, $3.99 to continue. You know,
That's great. That would have been funny.
So, and again, like you said, it's got some interesting character moments and stuff like that. It's got some good stuff, but not in a way that makes me think I need to read that next issue or that I need to avoid the next issue either.
Yeah. What I don't think you're going to get is, as a fan of the, if you were a super fan of the video game, you're not really getting any new stuff here. There's nothing grounded in that world because, again, there's nothing there. So it's basically name recognition of a centipede. You kind of know what the monster's going to look like and what it's going to be. And it's one person against said huge centipede. I mean, that's kind of the only thing that's from the video game. So, and what else is there?
It's funny because I would recommend this to people who kind of think there ought to be like more challenge type comics released, because the basic thing here, and again, Max Bemis did a great job with the challenge is, here's a video game that doesn't have much story from many decades ago. Turn it into a compelling comic book issue. Can you do that? I think the answer is, in this case, yes. Can he turn it into a compelling series? Still not sure.
Yeah, but we're doubtful. We're a little doubtful on whether that's possible. But it is possible.
I'd almost rather they follow this up, and I'd be mixing video game franchise companies, so forgive me if I am. But like with the next issue being Joust or Missile Command could be fun. Yeah. Pong would be – that would be an expert challenge level kind of a deal. But if you were to take the video games from the era of you have a joystick and a fire button and that's it, or the equivalent of a paddle and button or whatever type deal, and limited graphics, and turn that into a compelling story. In some cases, it can certainly be done. Other cases, maybe not. That's the kind of mindset I enjoyed this comic in quite a bit. And if this had – if this had been, instead of, say, from Dynamite, if it had been an Image comic by an unknown creator or something with an unknown property, and this was just some alien thing, I actually might continue with the next issue. I don't know. It's everything it has in here, I think the writer brought and didn't leverage from the property, if you know what I mean.
Yeah.
So it's good. It's just I don't know where they go next or for how long they can go.
Yeah, I mean, I'm gonna stick with it for one more issue, just to see. But I don't want to say that it's the greatest thing I ever read. I just was kind of impressed that it wasn't a train wreck. And maybe if, because there is a player two option in Centipede, you can have two players can play. And maybe if it was a second person and not that inanimate object he was talking to, there would have been a little something more to compel me into the next issue. If I recall also, I think after the success of Centipede, they came out with Millipede as a sequel. So if this does well, we look for that upcoming series from Dynamite, maybe as a successor, a next volume. That'd be kind of fun.
If this does well, they're going to mine the entire Atari library of properties.
Yeah. I haven't read Sword Quest yet. It's sitting on my nightstand. So that one came out already.
Yeah.
And it won't be long before every single thing they have the rights to will be cranked out if this sells well enough. And I have to admit, I did order the Atari game covers. Of the Sand Sword Quest. I was sucked in, so I'm that guy.
I did not do that, but I will admit to having a complete run of all 20 issues of Atari Force that DC did back in the 80s.
Yeah, I would imagine that. I have a few issues. I don't have the full run.
It was not a bad sci-fi sort of a thing, and as I recall, it might have been Jose Luis Garcia Lopez might have done the art on that.
He's no slouch.
No, not at all. So I think Atari has plenty of properties that are worth bringing back. This was, again, a surprisingly fun story. It's just one where I don't know where they're going to go or if I need to go for it. If you get that next issue, let me know how it is and if I should follow up with this.
Will do.
I'm going to go with a B rating on this. It was surprisingly fun.
Yep, I'm at a B minus, and it's... It was a surprise that I enjoyed it as much as I did. Art's pretty good, story's pretty good. I just usually that would be a more wholehearted endorsement from me, but I just can't see it. I just can't see it continuing and where it goes from here. But maybe.
Yeah, I'm curious. So yeah. Shall we move on to our next comic?
Yes.
That is Colossi number 4. It is from Vault Comics. We talked about the first issue of this series a couple of months back. I had read the second issue when it came out. I then got behind on my reading, so I read the third issue right before I read this. And there were a couple of things about this. One, there was one or two places it got a little more violent or gory than I kind of like, and that surprised me, actually.
Corkscrew?
Yeah.
Okay.
Injury to eye thing. It's again, I'm squeamish. I have a zero tolerance for that. But one of the other things I've been doing for the last few episodes, when I remember to, and I often forget, is I found a little stopwatch app on Windows 10. So for a couple of these things, I'm sitting in front of my computer to take notes anyways. Start the stopwatch, read the thing. How long does it take? Because part of it is we're doing a bunch of episodes kind of back to back, and I wanted to know, get a sense of how long does it take me to review a comic. I read this in under 4 minutes, and it was a very quick read, and not in the best of ways. I mean, I like the issue, I like the miniseries, but it's got some shortcomings.
Yeah.
I really have no clue what's going on with these possessions and all of that stuff.
Nope.
To the point, I even went back through the previous issues to see if I could follow, is this an entity hopping from body to body to body, or what's going on? And I don't know.
Well, it's Gulliver's Travels. I mean, I didn't recognize it connection at first, but I think based on the ending that that's what they're going for.
I don't think so. Yes, I see the reversal there at the ending, but I didn't take that as a Gulliver's Travels sort of a thing.
No.
I think you're giving it a little more credit because I think Gulliver's Travels had a bit more kind of social commentary. This, I just felt like half the story wasn't being told.
Well, I breezed through 2, 3, and 4 in short order. And, you know, to your point of, you know, 4 minutes on that final one, I believe it because they all felt pretty breezy, pretty light. And then after I finished, I thought, well, maybe I missed like some extra pages, you know, I better check because when you read things digitally, you don't feel the full weight of a comic that it's at the end. And, you know, sometimes you can just, maybe there's a few more pages. So I had to go back and check. No, I had finished them all. And yeah, very little happened. There were kernels of things mm-hmm. that were interesting to me throughout. Never fully explored. What happened to the little kid that got thrown up on the shelf and kind of dissected?
I miss that? I think he's in the box there at the end.
He's in the box in the truck.
No, that the lady's holding on the page before the end. We've got the bus, the splurch at the bottom of that page. But that's my point, is there's aspects of the story that's just unclear.
What does that mean for
that box, the thing that has the latch and opens up, if we go back an issue or two, he was put in the box by the storekeeper.
Right. So what happens to that guy?
I have no idea.
Yeah, but this is the end of the comic. And I have no idea what happens to that guy.
He's the
driving force in the whole thing from the beginning. He was injured, so they were getting him water, and right?
Well, and presumably that may have been where the possession thing came from, but it may not have been. I don't know. And this is why I feel like not all the story was told. It's like we're getting abbreviated versions, maybe there's missing scenes. There's something that was in the minds of the creators, hopefully, that was just not put onto the page.
Yeah, I've used this analogy before, but it felt like an Outer Limits episode, not a Twilight Zone episode, where the Twilight Zone episodes were really usually more satisfying, more well thought out. The Outer Limits were, some were good, some were a little less, maybe a little rushed, maybe they're not fully formed ideas. That's kind of what I felt like here, that it had the kernel of something good,
mm-hmm.
and it didn't stick the landing. It had plenty of room to tell a story. It had 4 issues, and it just chose to meander and not quite hit all the notes you would need to really be a satisfying read.
I think the story needed to be more focused. I would say not only is it sort of like your Outer Limits episode like you're suggesting, but I would say it's like a modern-day rerun of an old one, where they cut stuff out to fit more commercials, and you're not even getting the full episode. You know what I mean?
Yeah, some of the things they chose to get rid of are kind of gone because the things in the beginning that were so important, you know, that the one guy's struggle with, and he kept trying to derail everything and was out for himself, and so one of the issues he kind of stole all the water for himself. I think I'm gonna be like issue 2 or 3.
Yeah, 2 or 3. Running. He was getting attacked by ants and was trying to use it to wash himself off, and that did not go over well.
But it just didn't go anywhere.
Yes.
You know, and that was way too much screen time for not really going anywhere. And so why was that there? And then they kind of left some other things out. So I don't think this is a bad comic by any stretch of the imagination. I just think it left some meat on the bone and didn't quite get everything done that it should have done to be a complete 4-issue miniseries.
I would agree with that. It's, again, not a bad comic, but it's not a great comic. And this is part 4 of 4, and it doesn't give a satisfying conclusion. There's a lot of story elements. It's unclear what's going on. And Well, I think a lot of that goes down to the script by Ricardo Moe, which, again, has some good moments throughout the run. I think the editor needed to step up the plate a little bit more and act as that audience member who's trying to figure out what's going on and ask some more questions to Ricardo, the writer, and just say, hey, can you explain this? Can you clarify this? Can you tighten the story up? Because I think this could have been a much better comic than I think it was. It was just, I mean, again, the twist at the end I should have seen coming, but I didn't bother to think it through. It's like, okay, but how does that tie into what's going on here? And I'm left with not even questions, although I could easily formulate probably a dozen or two if I needed to, but just a sense of ambiguity on the story. And it leaves it with a does it really matter sense in my mind.
So Colossi 2, the next volume, will you check that first issue out?
Probably not. You?
Yeah, I really don't think the way it ended leaves any doubt where it's going to go, and I don't think I care about that story enough to revisit it.
Interesting, because I think it leaves a ton of doubt of where it goes. Does it follow the people in the truck as they leave Tolerance?
No, I think they've said everything they're going to say about that, and the next one would be
this new story they seem to be starting at the end.
This new story that they're starting at the end, and that's what I'm less interested in. So maybe there's a Colossi 5 coming.
It said 4 of 4 at the beginning.
I know. But it feels like it needs one, right?
No, it feels like it needed more in the existing issues.
No, I think there's, I don't know. I mean, I guess it's like your sci-fi movie that, you know, your B movie that just kind of ends with a lot of ambiguity, and perhaps they live happily ever after. Perhaps they don't. I don't know.
Too many things are up in the air for this to be remotely satisfying of an ending.
Yeah.
And for them to tease, they may go in a completely different direction with a follow-up miniseries. Disappointing.
That would also be very disappointing and not satisfying.
So, yeah, there were aspects of the run that were entertaining, but they didn't land the ending. There's too many things left ambiguous or whatnot, and it was an unsatisfying conclusion to the story. This issue in particular, I think, kind of meandered and didn't really pull together. I'm going to go with a C rating. It was just kind of there.
Yeah. I would say the first issue is still my favorite, and this might have been second or third. I think either two or three, which they kind of blended together. One of them was a real stinker, and nothing at all really happened, and one of them was all right. So overall, I would say this is probably is a C. I'm going to give this particular issue a little notch above and give it a C+. But yeah, it's disappointing. I thought it started a little stronger with a lot more potential and just didn't finish up its promise of the first issue.
Well, and even if you start off great, I mean, the two most important parts of the story are how you start it and how you end it.
True.
Because if you don't start strong, people don't stick with you, and what they're going to remember the most is going to be the ending.
Yeah.
I can't tell you how many times I've watched a TV show or a movie with my sister. We do an episode, and one of the first things she tends to jump to is how it ended. And granted, that's freshest in our mind because it's what we just saw, but still. You don't land the ending, which they didn't do here. It taints the story. It's a shame. I'll keep an eye on what Vault does, but this... They've now got a little bit more barrier to entry for me to get me into a new title. Not significantly more, but enough, just enough more.
Yeah, and a lot of their titles, they tend to have questionable content that doesn't line with your sensibilities anyway. So
yeah,
not all of them, but based on the solicits, are even going to get by your sensibilities. So even if it does, now you have to another reason to pause a little bit and think about it.
Exactly. And it's not to say they should be trying to get me as a reader necessarily. But in this day and age, I would try to get as many readers as I could if I were a creator.
Yeah. There's a finite amount.
And seems to be dwindling, not growing. But mm-hmm. Yeah. Shall we move on to our other book?
Yeah.
This is War for the Planet of the Apes, number 1 of 4 from Boom Studios. Now, I will admit I am at least a movie or two behind on the new Apes films. I've, of course, watched all the classic ones, so I'm familiar with the basic saga, just not the revamped one. But I really thought this issue gave me kind of everything I needed to understand and enjoy the story kind of roughly where the world's at, what the status quo is, and, you know, we're at that, frankly, a little past the tipping point. The apes haven't necessarily taken over yet, but it's clear that the world's kind of theirs for the taking.
Yeah.
And this whole transition period from human rule to ape rule, I think, is an interesting time in the franchise. And I thought they did a really fun job exploring it. And we bounce between different groups and people and stuff. But even with all those characters, all that stuff going on, I thought there was a solid narrative flow nonetheless. There are other times where it's like they cut to another scene. And I'm like, well, what's this doing here? And I never really felt that way here. I thought the art was good. I'm not saying it's outstanding or the best I've ever seen, but it was solid and it worked. And I particularly enjoyed how, with the apes, when they were communicating, we would often get a caption box with a line to the ape that's doing it, enough of them either pointing or gesturing or doing the sign language, and the line typically going to the hand to indicate they're communicating through sign language. And it conveyed that concept, which I was familiar with from the first of the new movies, or maybe the second, whichever one I saw. And they didn't feel the need to, like, hammer that home or something and start out with them, you know, spelling stuff out, close-ups of the hands and all that kind of stuff. They got the point across. They moved on. It was functional. It was good. I liked it. There were a number of places I thought things easily could have gotten gory, and it didn't. So I appreciated that. But there was also an aspect of, I would not want to live in this world. These no. apes are scary.
No, I don't think either one of us would do very well.
I think it would be a very short. If this was the John in the Planet of the Apes, it would be a half issue miniseries. First page would be what the hell happened. Second issue would be me dead.
Perhaps if the court, if the apes needed a court jester, I could last a little longer.
Well, you know the old story. You don't need to run faster than the bear, just faster than the other guy.
Yeah, that's true.
So, I did think the likenesses or the apeness of the apes was fun, was good. I enjoyed the issue.
Yeah, I saw I haven't seen this movie yet.
I don't think it's been released yet.
Okay, well that's good. Maybe that's why I haven't seen it. But I've seen the one. Is there one or two before this?
I saw the one that had James Franco. There was another one that had Kerry Russell that I have not seen. I thought there might have been another one. Actually, I think there was another one before the James Franco one that had Matt Damon. No, not Matt Damon.
I saw that one. I think that was a remake, whereas the James Franco is like a prequel.
Which, again, sort of follows the timeline of the original movies.
And so this one is kind of a continuation of that James Franco, what James Franco movie started, which mm-hmm. none of the names of the movies stick in my head, but something Planet of the Apes.
Or and Planet of the Apes something. It's one of those.
One of those. But yeah, I enjoyed those, but I had forgotten like who the, you know, Caesar, new Caesar, but I couldn't remember any of the other ape characters. So I don't know. I didn't really know who was who, but that's okay. And I haven't seen enough of the trailers to know who the actors are that the humans are based on. So I didn't really recognize them. So I don't really know if they're doing likenesses or not. I think Woody Harrelson's in it, so it might be the bald guy there. That's who that character is, perhaps. But I had fun anyway. Of the apes books that we've reviewed over the last couple of years, this is probably one of my favorites. And I thought I did a pretty good job of setting a table mm-hmm. for what was to come, and it was pretty interesting. The art's a little rudimentary, not super detailed, but it, you know, the apes, you can tell the apes apart, you can tell the people apart.
Mm-hmm.
Colors are a bit muted, but yeah, I liked the way it was lettered. I thought that was cool, and I think the story's pretty interesting and kind of shows the tension building and how we're going to get from point A to point Z and to those next set of movies that we're also familiar with.
Well, again, the original set of movies are its own timeline, and there was time travel in there too, whereas this is taking place in the new timeline of movies. So, but yeah, what I liked is the art.
I thought the Charlton Heston movies are actually him coming back to after this happened.
Well, he goes into the future.
Spoiler.
Yes, spoiler,
he comes to Earth. It's actually Earth the whole time.
He goes to the Planet of the Apes, has the first movie, has another movie, they blow up the Planet of the Apes. The next movie, it turns out Apes had escaped into the past by reversing his flight path or some such. That takes us into the past and leads back forward. And that seems to be more or less kind of, with minus the time travel, maybe some of what they've done here.
Okay, I was thinking this was leading into the Charlton Heston world.
I don't think so.
Okay.
I think it'll lead to a world much like what he was from, because I think that was the first of the movies they redid. So, again, there's an iconic aspect of the Planet of the Apes stuff. They're just retelling the story. And I felt they were leveraging the movies without being reliant on the movies. And I felt the apes looked and moved like apes, stuff like that. So they sold the concept for me. For me, very solid B rating. Don't know that I'll continue with it necessarily. Maybe I will, but it certainly has me a bit more interested to catch up on this set of movies.
Yeah, yeah. It kind of reminded me of what I liked about that first rebooted movie, and I gave it a B+. I think there's a lot of good stuff in here, and it is one of I think we've something with apes in it. We've reviewed every 3 or 4 months, it feels like. So
I wouldn't say that often, because I'm not reading a whole lot of ape stuff.
So, but this is one of my favorites.
We might have done the Star Trek and the Planet of the Apes, and we might have done the Green Lantern and the Planet of the Apes, and an actual apes book.
Yeah. So
we've done a fair number. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Maybe more than I've realized. So anyways, good stuff. Fun. We'll see where it goes. Or somebody will see where it goes. I don't know if I will.
I think I'll read one more for sure. Whether I do the whole series, I don't know. It depends. It's only 4 issues, so.
True. If you read the next one, let me know. I think it's certainly worth following. It's just I'm way behind on my reading, so adding more things is I got to think about.
Yes, that's a tough ad.
But it's one of those things, I think your confusion with the movies here is, are they telling a different story? Are they reinventing a story? Or do they just not know the story they're telling? Because we hit that in the comics all the time.
Yeah, I had run across that with Super Sons 5 when I read that. At one point, Alfred tells Damien, this is why I didn't have children, you know, because he's mad at him. And I thought,
because Damien's being Damien, I bet. Damien's I haven't read that one yet.
And I thought I must have missed some kind of retcon or something, because I'm almost positive, 99.9% sure Alfred has a daughter that we've spent some time with in some other comics.
And I would go so far as to say she is the secondary character in the Batwoman title.
Yeah, and nothing that I have heard has erased that from continuity. So is that a is that just an editorial oversight? Is it on purpose? Should I be annoyed? Should I just let it go? Is it unforgivable? I don't know. That kind of stuff, sometimes I let it wash off my back, and sometimes it bothers me and annoys me weeks later, as in this case. I'm still annoyed by it.
Well, they've played enough in this area with Alfred, his daughter, and stuff in the New 52 Rebirth era, that to say he doesn't have a daughter rings false when she's, again, one of the lead characters, the secondary lead, I would say, over in the Batwoman title. You know, playing the equivalent role of Alfred, and very much it's Julia Pennyworth. So Alfred may say he didn't have kids, but we've got evidence to the contrary. But this is where the DC continuity over the years, and particularly of late the New 52, has unraveled a bit. Because if you follow the Batman Inc. Storyline, it kind of crosses through into the New 52 a bit from before and after without really missing a beat. Okay, fine. They rename the characters of the two Batgirls to other characters or whatever, but you still have the Cassandra Cain, who we get reintroduced as Orphan, and the Stephanie Brown, who we get reintroduced later as Spoiler, as she originally was. And it's like, well, wait a sec, these stories can't both be in the same continuity. They don't match. They conflict with one another. And when it's just an offline like that or something, I'm willing to give them a little bit of leeway. But Damien's comeback really should have been, well, what would Julia, your daughter, have to say about that?
Which would have been great.
And in character.
Editor's note would have just been a bunch of Z's.
Yeah.
Asleep at the wheel.
Well, it's funny because there have been a number of times I've knocked a book because I thought it was out of continuity with how I thought they'd left certain characters. And I'll be honest, there have been many times I've been wrong. You know, I was knocking one book of, well, that's not how we left U.S. Agent, but apparently there had been some story that had slipped my mind and they had done this, this is what happened, and oh, he could be in that situation.
Yeah.
But there have been also plenty of times where they just kind of gloss over stuff and never explain things. So how do you get from, like, the Venom Space Knight series to the current Venom series? Well, it took them about 6 months or six issues to go and get around to explaining that. That's not fair. That also, in not fair, okay, who cares? Life isn't fair. Yes, believe me, I get that. But as a paying customer for your stories, there's a certain aspect of these writers start out with a blank piece of paper and can make the rules up as they go along. If they say something is true, Alfred has a daughter. Okay, great. You have said it. I will believe it. Now you're saying he doesn't. Now I'm confused. Now I'm annoyed. Now I'm wondering, should I be bothering to read your stories if you can't be bothered to read them as you write them? Or, you know what I mean? To me, it's a sign of respect or lack thereof towards the audience. There was a run of Avengers, I think by Chuck Austin, but I could be wrong. And it was entertaining, but a lot of the characters were just completely out of character from how they'd been previously established. And it was done under kind of the guise of, well, it's a good story, though, isn't it? Yes, but it conflicts with what's gone before, which was also good stories.
Yeah, equally as important.
Yeah, you know, you can't kind of have it both ways. But I think in this day and age, we're at the point where writers are tossing ideas out, and they are not all of them, but it seems like too many of them, are playing for the laugh of the moment, the applause of the moment, whatever you want to call it. And if they either write themselves into a corner, or they're worse, they will put out something of, this is intriguing, don't you want to know what's going on here? And play for time until people basically forget about the question, and then just kind of deftly turn away and move on to another subject. I don't recall if we ever got the answers to a lot of the questions that were kind of kicked out right after the Secret War stuff over at Marvel. Maybe we found out who the father of Spider-Woman's child was, but I don't remember. And there were a couple of other things that they had doled out of, well, we'll get around to telling you this at some point, but that's not important now. And then it gets towards, it's never important. Now, sure enough, there's going to be some listener who's got a better memory for this stuff than I do, and is hopefully going to tell me, yeah, they answered the question, it was this, they revealed it here, this is what's going on. And I'll be, oh yeah, I forgot, because maybe it wasn't that memorable. Or there's going to be somebody else who's equally well-read as I am, and is going to say, you're right, they never did explain that. And neither is necessarily right or wrong for how it happened, but you get enough of these things that fly in the face of continuity and could have easily been, easily is a relative term, but could have been caught. Again, any editor in the Bat office should know that Julia Pennyworth is starring in this other series. Any editor in the Superman office should know that too.
And when they were introduced, or that they exist, and maybe just shoot an email to the creator and say, oh, by the way, don't forget about this. It seems pretty simple to me.
Imagine if you lived in a comic book world where not only are plot lines dependent on the memory and skill of the writers, but the laws of physics were too. You could go from issue to issue and suddenly gravity's gone. Because they just, well, I forgot about it. We don't have gravity here. That would be a wild world to live in.
And there's a thing, you know, about being all in with a line, a shared universe, where readers they're rewarded. There are times when everything comes together and there are callbacks and Easter eggs and there's some really rewarding stuff that a longtime reader who's read the line, they get that benefit, and it's highly satisfying. I don't know that because I'm not all in anymore in those two areas, but I have been in the past where I've been reading all or most of something, and it's really cool when you get that connection and that fan service, and it really feels like you're part of something, and it makes you more loyal, and it makes you stick through the low times on comics, I think. And so when they dismiss it, and not only don't reward you for your longevity and loyalty to the line, but also to dismiss it as having never existed. Probably not on purpose. You know, nobody, they're not trying to go out and do these things, but it could be taken as, well, if it doesn't matter to you, why does it matter to me? Why should I even bother with reading
absolutely.
All these? There's no benefit.
There are times it's actually detrimental to have read a lot of comics. Because if you've been as deep in some of the stuff as I have for as long as I have, and somebody asks you, well, what's going on with this character? And you have to stop and think, no, wait, which version of this character is it? Have they killed this one off in this reality? Or has this version always been alive? Or wait, which origin did this one have? When did this character join this team versus the past lineup of the team where they joined at that point? You know, you've got conflicting memories to kind of align.
Yeah.
And it frankly, it kind of sucks.
Well, I mean, we just a week, last episode, we talked about Defenders.
Mm-hmm.
And there will be an entire generation of people, the only Defenders they know will be the Netflix Defenders. And this collection of this team that's in the new comics, and that old Defenders, which, you know, doesn't resemble this team at all, will not even thought of. It's just too distant and doesn't resemble it.
Well, I mean, one way you can kind of judge when somebody kind of got into the X-Men is by asking them who the original members were.
Yeah.
You know, because different people, it's like, well, I came in with the X-Men cartoon, though it'll be this. Others will be, well, I came in with the movie, it'll be that, you know? And then they're the ones who actually came in with the comics. And they're going to say it's clearly these five teenagers that were pulled forward in time.
Yeah.
You know, it's nuts.
Yeah. Who's your Batman? Yeah. Is it Adam West? Is it Michael Keaton? Is it,
it's one thing to say which is the iconic version or which do you identify most with in terms of an actor in the role. But when you start to get to the history of the characters, who were the original members of the Justice League, that should be something that is kind of carved in stone.
It's the Super Friends.
I would accept that answer.
It is the Super Friends to me.
It's funny because Adam Murdo of Comic Geek Speak did a thesis on continuity and all of that stuff. I don't know if they still have a link to it on their website or not, but it's a fascinating read. And he talks about continuity as kind of a cultural currency that you spend by being able to explain, oh, I know this, how about this, let me explain this type stuff to you, or that gratification when you read something like The Forge we read a couple of weeks ago. And I'm enjoying it a lot because, oh, I recognize that. Oh, they brought that back. Oh, that's cool. You know, it hit nostalgia buttons or things for me that if you don't know what these are, you're like, well, what's the big deal? You know, it's a cultural currency that companies can either cash in on or devalue. Every time they do a reboot, a reimagining, a retooling, or a stupid line that contradicts blatantly known facts, or what should be blatantly known facts, or easily disprovable things.
Yeah.
It devalues that continuity currency and the attachment to the world, to the characters. It makes it seem less real.
Yeah.
You know, if you go into a building, you're like, wow, this place is amazing. But then you lean against the wall and it starts to give and you realize, wait, this is just like a movie set. This is just a facade. You know, this is cheap plasterboard that's painted. It's not really metal or something, you know. Your view of where you're at suddenly radically changes. And to the point where you may start to feel you've been swindled or something. And certainly, Marvel and DC, I think, have both gone through times where the readers have been disenfranchised because they've spent time, money, emotional investment, and attachment to characters that the writer's like, yeah, well, we don't care about that. We're just undoing it. You know, and there have been a couple of times with some major characters that through the convenient timing of event titles or whatnot, their status quo just suddenly changed to how they would like it to be. You know, again, a good example of that, I could point to a number, actually, of good examples of that, where they go into leading up to an event over at Marvel with characters in a particular status quo. The event happens and they come out and suddenly the status quo is just different for those characters. You know, sometimes completely inexplicably, sometimes there's just a little hand waving of, yeah, well, we fixed it. And it's when you've got that get out of jail free card, it feels you haven't really earned your story progression. And again, they can make the rules up as they go. They just need to kind of follow them. So they need to give a little thought to the rules they do.
Yeah.
But to me, that's the difference between like a good science fiction novel and a fantasy novel. good science fiction novel, they're going to actually give some thought as to this is how things work. And if you say A and B and C follows directly from A and B being true, then, well, C can happen. Unless there's an unknown D thing that would contradict it, prevent it, whatever, and they've kind of set that up too. But in the comics, they just they don't bother thinking about that at times. Some writers absolutely do. They're typically the better writers.
Yeah.
But it makes me wonder if long-term customers are really wanted in the hobby anymore. You look at how much continuity they've thrown out at various companies, and even without throwing out continuity, the number of titles they've rotated through, the volumes they've rotated through, every one of these reboots and retooling alienates long-time readers to some degree. And there comes a point of, why should I keep giving you my money if all you want to do is take my money? And I think we're seeing this play out in many aspects of the industry.
I think they know that the longtime reader is where their bread is buttered. And that it's not the quote-unquote new comic reader that is going to prop them up and sell 8 or 9 million copies of comics every month. So I think they want you. I think they want you, and they don't want you to go anywhere ever.
I hope they do, but I see a lot of evidence sometimes to the contrary.
They hope they probably send you a case of vitamins and hope you live forever, John, because you are the type of customer they want more of.
Again, they stand more to lose if I kick the bucket than if somebody buying one or two titles does. I get that, but there are times where I don't see the evidence of that. And I'm not saying they should be catering to those of us who buy just a crazy amount of comics to the exclusion of others. I'm saying any customer they have,
yeah,
is cheaper to keep than to acquire a replacement, and they should value that business truism.
Yes. And is it as simple as tell better stories, or is there something downplay shenanigans? Is there something that you're pointing to that you think is an easy fix for them?
I think the constant going after of new readers and throwing out the old because it didn't work implies a devaluing of longtime readers. And I think if they were to, they being the creators, the publishers, the editors, everybody involved with the creation of the material, were to really focus a bit more on reader retention, that would make such a profound impact on the industry as to not even be funny. We are in a point where there are more TV shows, movies, books, video games, etc. on comic-related stuff that, I mean, we can't get any more culturally accepted as a hobby, a medium, a genre, whatever you want to call it, than we are now. Yet sales are always going down because they can't keep the reader. So there's not the return on the investment. Then every time it's like, well, yeah, a few people are liking this, but that's not enough. We're going to get rid of that. We're going to do a whole bold new direction and forget everything that's gone before. Yeah, I know you've spent a lot of time and money reading that and you were invested in it emotionally, but who cares? That's the sort of thing that I think is the self-defeating aspect of the industry that I see at times.
Yeah, I mean, like, it is culturally acceptable, but yet there's probably 500,000 comic readers out there, and at least direct market comic readers, I'm guessing. And you know, that's the same number of subscribers Loot Crate has. You know, and wow, I just think that they're either the digital sales are wildly underreported, and
which I don't think they are,
or it's just so it's a niche it's a dying niche that's never going to get any larger. And I hope that's not the case.
Well, I think on the path it is, it's going down that route. It doesn't have the return in for the investment. So to get more people into comics, you need to have more pages for fewer dollars, which is a tough nut to crack. I get that. And there's a cap to how big the audience is. Not everybody who goes and sees one of these Marvel or DC movies or whatever is going to go to a comic store. Fine. But if you get them into that comic store through Free Comic Book Day or something like that, try to keep them. You know, if you look at the sales trends for comics, the aggregate of the top 300 for the last 10 years, during which time we've had an explosive growth in popularity of the Marvel characters through movies, television, etc. The DC stuff's done phenomenal with Arrow, Flash, etc. There's all the cartoons, all this other stuff. There's been Free Comic Book Day. Comics are even getting mentioned on the late night talk shows. I mean, Conan O'Brien goes to Comic-Con every year. yet we're really not seeing the needle move up dramatically in terms of aggregate sales. So it's like it's a churn-based model, and it shouldn't be. And anyone who doubts that, go look at the sales numbers and look at the average issue-to-issue change and how, like, 85 to 90% of it is typically down. And of those that have changed, there's a large percentage that are just new number ones. There's nothing to compare to, but still. It's I get every so often you've got to reinvigorate the property. You've got to reboot it. You've got to retool it, be it another branch of the Star Trek franchise, another trilogy of the Star Wars stuff. Be it taking the Star Trek stuff to a new series of movies in a more action-y, adventure-y kind of a timeline, that's fine. But those are do it every couple of decades, not every other year.
And I think, part of the problem is I think that there are such a small number of people in the industry that have been, and a lot of them have been doing this for a while, and they themselves are probably feeling it. It gets stale to them if you're in it for that long of a period of time. And why not shake it up? Why not? You know, it's an easy sell to why don't we do this? Where why don't we do a new 52? Everything is relaunched and we get to shape it in our image, and everything, all the old continuity is shoved in 5 years. And let's try that. Wouldn't that be fun? And it's an easy sell in the room. Because these guys have been doing this for so long, they're probably tired of it, and they want some change. It's to entertain themselves.
Yeah, but that's not their job. Their job is to sell comics, and if you think you can sell it by cutting the connection people have with these characters, it took me until really the new 52 to, and I'm not even going to say fully grasp, but to grasp to the extent that I currently do, a comment Mark Waid, I think, had made. Maybe it was Kurt Busiek, one of the two, a while back when somebody was asking, what do you think of Superman? And this was post-Crisis. And the response is, it's good. It's just not my Superman. You know, it's a different character. Oh, but it's still Superman. It's like, yeah, it's not. And I get it.
Yeah, now you get it.
Well, because we're two Superman past that.
Yeah.
Maybe three or four, depending how you count. And I don't begrudge new vision, new takes, and stuff like that. Or reinvigorating and trying to get things spiced back up. But there comes a point where I think you can and should do that by building on what you've got before, not by obliterating what you've had before.
Yeah.
And Marvel, I think, has turned a major corner on that over the last year or two with the constant season-to-season event things, Secret Wars, etc. And the message they are effectively sending up until we get to this generation point, and maybe they'll be reversing it then, but I doubt it, is, you know what? These aren't your parents' heroes anymore. We don't need the original Thor, Iron Man, or any of this stuff. We'll just have somebody else in the suit. It's all the same. It doesn't really matter. You know, we don't need the Fantastic Four. These Defenders are just as good as those Defenders. It's all interchangeable parts. And I think that cuts down on the uniqueness of many of the characters and the appeal of many of the characters.
Well, we as a collective readership have to bear some of the blame, because our attention span over time, it wanes, and we like the shiny new number one, and then 30% of us go away if we're lucky, and then come back for issue two, and 30% more leave again, and it can be a really, really well written comic. That's a great story from beginning to end, and it still has a significant attrition from issue to issue because we don't have the attention span, or we just like number ones, or I don't know what it is, but it's not the story.
There's a certain sampling aspect of, I'm just going to try the first issue with no intent of continuing. I get that. If it was just things took a little bit, but then they leveled off, fine. They get out of the honeymoon period. That's cool, but that's not what's happening. They continue to go down and down and down. And even to the point where across volumes, you can often see a clear trend line across them. It's like, well, here's how it was in volume one. Oh, they got a little bump when they launched volume two. Oh, it's right back to where it was at the end of volume one. And it keeps going down. Oh, bump for the first issue of volume three. Oh, and then it's back down to where it was. You know, and continuing to arc down and down. And I would argue, if it really is that good of a story, that compelling of a character or whatever, then they'd retain sales. I mean, I'm not even saying 100%. If you could retain 99% on a consistent basis, you're doing really well. But we've got 2, 3, 4, 5% on average easily, probably more than I haven't done the standard attrition calculation in quite some time. That's just the fall off every issue. And it's one of those things, it's Zeno's paradox or whatever, to get across the street, you get halfway, then halfway, then halfway, then halfway. And there comes a point where, yeah, you're not technically at the other side of the street, but you're close enough, you're tripping over the curb, you know, that you can only lose so many, you know, that standard attrition rate, whatever it may be, so many times before you're just out of sales. The guy from Comics Experience, Andy Schmidt, has done a really good panel a couple of years at C2E2 and maybe also San Diego, where he's like, okay, you know, if you want to do a comic, figure you're going to sell this much, you know, put a number out there giving a little justification for it, and then, okay, you want to do 5 issues, well, why 5 issues? Well, if you start at this number X, whatever it may be, you're going to be down here with the second, down here at the third, here at the fourth, there at the fifth, and you know what? After that, you're probably just not going to make any money if you're still making money at that point.
Yeah, you're losing money. So he recommends a 3-issue miniseries. No longer.
Well, it's one of those, if it's too short, they don't have the retailers don't have time to course correct. That doesn't work well either. If it's too fast, it's things need to change in the industry in terms of the format and the structure and the nature of stories for it to be a long-term viable medium. It's one of those things where I do think there's an aspect of this may go the way of the radio drama. Now, it may not be for another 20 years or something, but it could be sooner than that. You know, it's hard to justify $3.99 for some of these comics.
And I'm sure over on the newspaper page, Comic Network, the weekly newspaper spotlight episode, they're discussing the trend line of newspaper subscriptions and how it's trending downwards. So it's just possible that print is dead and comics are part of that and can't recover.
I don't think print is dead. I do, however, think there's a very convincing case that reading is dead or dying at the very least.
What would tell you that print isn't dead? The magazines that fold, the newspapers that shutter and shed employees.
There is a ongoing
the books that are less and less
a permanent format of print. It will get used less and less and used differently, but it's just like we've never gone to a perfectly paperless office. There's a time you just need the tangible aspect. I don't think that'll ever die, but it's not like we're seeing ebooks explode and print is dead. It's people don't spend the time to read. And I want to differentiate the two. It's the activity, not the format, that's dying. I challenge listeners and you to go to your place of work or your social network of friends. Ask what and when was the last book they read. Then, for a bonus one, what was the one before that? A lot of people aren't going to have a good answer for that. Some are going to have tons, and they'll talk endlessly, so be careful who you ask.
Yeah.
But
there are still the folks around the water cooler that have always have a book in their hand. But yeah, there's fewer of them.
But they're identifiably a reader versus not. And you could probably also walk around the office and spot who's the person who very identifiably has a dog or is into a particular sport or something of that sort. There's a point where it becomes part of their self-identity, which is cool. I got nothing against that. I mean, comics are clearly part of mine. It's just a matter of when do we hit the point of not even diminishing returns, but of the tipping point. When do we cross the line where it's just not viable anymore? I mean, when we're seeing even Marvel and DC books sometimes getting into the 4,000, 5,000, 6,000 unit sales range, you know.
Well, they're gonna all start shifting to $3.99. They're already 75% there, and then more and more will shift to $4.99. And until there's a reader backlash of boycott, even that'll continue because as they sell less and less, they need the profit margins. So I get it, but I just don't like it. And
I think
like,
they need to find
point,
a way to be more cost effective.
Return on investment.
Yeah, exactly.
You said you took you 4 minutes to read a $3.99 comic. That's not sustainable. Nobody wants to spend $4 for 4 minutes.
Going back to Centipede, the Atari comic, I got a better return on my investment, even on video games I was horrible at. It was, and even when I go to the current arcades at the fancier places where it's a couple of bucks to go play the thing. even if I die inside of 3 minutes, I've gotten a better return on my investment than a couple of these comics, which is sad.
It is.
But it's...
And I don't know the solution.
Solution is better return on investment, stronger stories, stickier stories that are harder to forget, and that are more compelling to come back to the next issue. That's easy to say, hard to execute on, and I get that. But it's at the point where... Have we hit a tipping point on some of these things where it's just not worth people's time to continue with what they've been doing for the past? I don't know. So this goes up...
On that depressing note.
Sorry. This goes up on the 24th. We're recording this early, so we're, again, trying to get some stuff to where I can basically enjoy Comic-Con and goof off, because I haven't gone there yet, even though it's over by the time you hear this. Typically, I have done a Comic-Con episode at the con. In the past, it's often been the podcasting panel. We're not having one this year because, frankly, we've gotten relegated over to the library, which, don't get me wrong, I love the Central Library. It's an awesome venue. It's about a 20-minute walk or whatever, so it's a bit of a, you know, out of the way if you're on the floor and stuff like that. It wasn't working. We had people coming and going in the middle of the panel so they could get to their next thing. So we've kind of opted to not keep doing it. We did it for, 10, 11 years and stuff. A lot of fun. I am going to try to set up a time with at least John Suntress, maybe one or two others over Skype after the convention, just to do kind of a wrap-up on that, because that's always fun. My sister and I are going to record, and by the time you've listened to this, have recorded, hopefully, our usual kind of evening commentaries on what we did during the day. Obviously, I'm going to need time to edit those episodes, and there are a couple of episodes that are going to go up first, because there's like the preview spotlight for August, there's the collector box light for June and July, there's going to be the mail reports for June, and coming up on August 23rd, 2017, it's the 10-year anniversary of the podcast. Technically, I started back in January, but I'm counting 10 years from when I started going weekly and haven't stopped. And yes, sometimes I'm not going to say we cheat. We get the episodes out weekly, and this is, another one where we've done weekly comic spotlight for the episodes they're releasing. It's just sometimes we record ahead.
We'll be renumbering at that point. We'll be calling that the first episode, the first weekly comic spotlight.
I had that in my notes. I was going to do that as the next episode tag for the one right before it.
All new, all different.
Rue
is replaced by a woman.
I want to do something funny for that, but Jason had a similar idea a while back. I'm curious what people think would be the funniest approach to take on that, because there's the temptation to do one and then renumber the episode between each segment. Preview spotlight deadline is going to be Saturday, August 5th. That's bright and early in the morning thereof. Solicits should be up, should have plenty to pick from. There should have been some cool announcements at Comic-Con, hopefully. And then we're going to do the comic book page teleconference on Saturday, August 19th at 7 p.m. Central. Sure, there's going to be plenty to talk about because of Comic-Con, what happened, what didn't happen, what else has been going on in the last month or two since we did a teleconference. Who knows? Maybe I'll have read some comics by then. If not, I'm going to be woefully behind. But yeah, plenty of stuff going on. Anything else? Or does that pretty much do it?
That'll do it.
Cool. Join us next time as we discuss Amazing Age number 2 from Alternate Comics, Barrier number 4 from PanelSyndicate.com, and Time and Vine number 1 from IDW.
The show notes and forum for this podcast can be found at www.comicbookpage.com under the podcast and forum sections of the website. Please email us at theguys@comicbookpage.com and let us know what you think of what was discussed in this episode. Thanks for listening.